Welcome to MoneyWeb at Midday, the actuality news show, offering unique insights and in-depth analysis featuring South Africa's top business leaders, newsmakers, and analysts for today's professionals. Your host, Jeremy Metz.
Thank you for listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. In the next 30 minutes, I'll go beyond the headlines with insight and analysis from leaders and decision makers shaping our future. Live or on demand, I'll bring you stories that keep you informed and ahead. Coming up on the program today, Transnet wins a rare vote of confidence with a new multi-million rand manganese deal. A landmark ruling puts employers on notice over dismissing foreign nationals. A survey shocker, South Africans give life insurers a glowing review. And hunting tourism pumping billions into rural South Africa. But at what cost? It's Friday, the 18th of July. Now, just days after a fresh credit ratings downgrade, Transnet must be celebrating. It secured a 10-year export contract with a manganese miner, UMK. My question today, is this a sign of renewed or growing resilience, or just a rare win in a troubled portfolio? I'm in conversation now with Yolisa Khani, Chief Business Development Officer at Transnet. Yolisa, a very warm welcome. And for Transnet itself and the organization very much on the back foot, how important is this deal?
Oh, Jeremy, that's a very good question. But let me start with the point that you made. It's certainly not a, we're not seeing it as a rare win, but we're seeing it as a vote of confidence. When we look at our abilities and our capabilities, moving bulk commodities is one of our strengths, notwithstanding the challenges that we've had. So certainly securing this 10-year commitment from call them customer number 12 is basically a big win for us. You will recall that there is a rail reform policy that was approved by Cabinet in 2023. What that means is that we're not going to be the only train operating company on our network, right? So I suppose customers are now spoiled for choice. For them to choose us again is certainly something that we are very proud of, and we are proud of the team that worked tirelessly towards getting this signed, and we are hoping to meet the commitments as they are outlined on the contract itself.
Well, let's talk about those commitments in just a moment, but how do you reconcile this long-term vote of confidence with the problems that exist at Transnet, including your spiraling credit risk?
Look, I mean, if you look at the credit risk itself, they acknowledge that we have these. And by the way, this is not the only long-term contract. We've got about 37 long-term contracts that we've signed with the coal industry. We've got Eskom in the bag as well. So there's a lot of them. And this has actually given the confidence to S&P and other rating agencies that we're certainly turning the corner. But as they say, are we turning it fast enough? And can we stand on our own 2 feet without a government guarantee? Essentially, that's the grab that they're having. But they certainly do acknowledge the fact that on the horizon lies something that looks like a recovery from Transnet's side.
Are you able to tell me what the deal is worth?
No, I can't. All I can say is that it's a 10-year commitment. And I think that collectively, though, I think it's over. If I look at all 16 contracts signed, you are looking at over 100 billion worth of revenue over a 10-year period.
So let's talk about that 10 years then. What guarantees have you had to give UMK that the rail system as it exists at the moment and into the future is not going to fail them?
Yeah, look, I mean, all of these contracts come with guarantees that we have contracted for X number of volumes. We are guaranteeing Y number of volumes. But most importantly, we are keeping the customers close enough in terms of our performance. We've put together measures, Jeremy, that allow us to work with our customers. There's one such is what we call the mutual cooperation agreement. In cases where we are unable to resolve a problem immediately as Transnet because we're a state-owned entity, they step in. As an example, if there's a derailment, we need to go through a procurement process that takes longer, and it's going to mark up because they're procuring for government. But when the customers procure on our behalf, it's usually quicker and it's usually cheaper. So that's one of those. The second one that we're working on is what we call a joint investment framework. And once that is approved, it will allow our customers collectively and together with us to invest in whatever needs to be invested in, both on the rail and the port side, to ensure that there is the operational efficiencies that are required to make sure that we meet those volumes. And we also, I mean, we meet with our customers quite frequently. At an executive level, we meet quarterly, and then there are those meetings that take place on a weekly as well as monthly to ensure that we meet our commitments. So there's a lot of transparency that we've brought back into our engagements.
In the short term, how difficult is it going to be to meet the contract's terms without major capital investment?
No, capital investment is the bane of our existence. That's where the issue lies. That maintenance backlog is a long-standing maintenance backlog. But again, as I said, that's something that we're looking at collectively. We've actually assessed the line together with our customers. We've jointly paid for that assessment. It's an independent assessment. We know what is broken. We know what needs to be fixed. And now we're looking at how quickly we can do that. And when we have those major annual shuts, we work with our customers, and they usually bring a much needed reprieve on the line itself. So to answer your question, you know, you're not going to run away from the fact that the problem is on the infrastructure over and above other things. But this one particular channel works quite well, if I may say.
I understand that Transnet has every reason to celebrate this deal, but is it not just about optics rather than actual progressive operational turnaround?
No, and I'll tell you why I say this. Had you asked me this question in 2023, I would have been nervous to respond, because at that time, we certainly were looking at a downward spiral. Year on year, I mean, we've improved. Last year, I think the year that just ended, we set at 52 million tons per annum, which is an improvement. So we are now, I think about 160 at the year that ended. The other year was 152, from in the 140s, high 140s. We are targeting 180 million tons, which we measure on a weekly basis. We're confident that, all things being equal, the trajectory is upwards and not downwards. There are still nuances, like cable theft is a serious issue. Vandalism of the network is another issue. But, you know, the locomotives, as much as it's much spoken about, that the challenges are also on the locomotive side. But the head of transit engineering has proven that she's worth the paper she's written on, because every other day we see new locomotives coming out of the depots onto the line.
Just a final question. Success in a big organization like yours, I would assume, relies a lot on diversification. And I wonder if Transnet has not become too dependent on long-haul bulk commodity deals, such as the one we're talking about.
Look, as I've indicated, that's one of our strengths, but we're mindful of the fact that, I mean, you've got the auto and the agri sector, which are both equally important for our country. So we do service them. But from a diversification point of view, Jeremy, you'll be glad to know that we've just resuscitated our subsidiary called Transnet International Holdings, which was set up for the purposes of looking for new revenue to grow and sustain our business. So we're quite excited. I mean, we've just recently taken that decision. We'll probably make that announcement in 3 months' time as we set it up, because there's a couple of things that we need to do. But also, you've probably seen in the news our private sector partnership that also enables us to participate in these private sector partnerships, not necessarily taking a major shareholdership, but, you know, just enough to be able to participate. So there's a lot of initiatives. It's just that because of the challenges that we're having and we've had in the past, the focus is always on those bulk commodities, which it should. People must keep us honest, and we are doing our best to recover.
Thank you very much indeed. Yolisa Kani, Chief Business Development Officer at Transnet.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
A recent Eastern Cape High Court ruling has sent a clear message. Even undocumented foreign nationals have the right to fair labour practice. The case involving a Zimbabwean municipal employee dismissed without following due process, and it is raising important questions for employers. So let's try and answer some of those. I'm in conversation now with Nivani Mudli, Associate Director at the law firm Weber Wenzel. So Nivani, welcome to you. And first of all, one's got to ask how a municipality managed to violate basic dismissal procedures. What's the background here? What went wrong?
Thanks, Jeremy. In this matter, a Zimbabwean national had worked for the municipality on a fixed-term basis since 2009 until his employment was ultimately terminated in November 2023. Now, he had at some point been employed in terms of a general work visa. However, the visa expired before his dismissal and was subsequently not renewed. And following its expiry, he did not possess any valid documentation permitting his lawful employment in South Africa. Mm. And despite this, the municipality continued to employ him up until the date of his dismissal. So what they did is that they simply issued a termination letter to him, and the municipality's justification for his dismissal was the expiry of his visa and the lack of his legal status to continue working in South Africa. The employee then challenged the fairness of his dismissal, and he launched an application before the court, contending that the dismissal was procedurally unfair and violated his right to fair labor practices. Ultimately, the court found that the employee's dismissal was unlawful and set it aside. While he did ask for reinstatement as well, that was not ordered, as the court found that that would not be practical in the circumstances, and compensation was also not granted. But importantly, the municipality was ordered to pay costs of the application.
So, Navani, help me understand this. If the visa had expired, why would the court have still found in his favor?
This is because all employees, in terms of the Labor Relations Act, are entitled to fair labor practices. So it's important for employers to follow proper procedure, even when dealing with an employee who may not have the legal capacity to live and work in South Africa.
But I'm seeing something of a contradiction here. Difficult, surely, to enforce immigration law while still protecting labor rights.
Mm. It is a balancing act. And what employers need to ensure is that at the outset, before they even employ any employee, even a foreign national employee, they need to conduct due diligence exercises and verification checks on those visas to make sure that the employee has the valid right to live and work in South Africa. So even if an employee produces a visa, provides that to the employer is still obligated to conduct a verification check to make sure that that visa is valid and is not fraudulent.
So let's talk about that due diligence then. What would that entail, and what are the risks then for employers who sidestep that obligation?
So firstly, like I mentioned, the employer would have to conduct verification checks. Mm. There's lots of different service providers who offer the service, such as MIE, for example. So before they employ anybody, they would have to conduct a background check, ask for the visa, and get that verified to make sure that they have the legal status to work here. And if they don't, there's ramifications. So for example, like in this matter, you would have seen that even though the employee wasn't reinstated and wasn't awarded compensation, the municipality had to pay costs in this matter. So generally speaking, if an employee is dismissed and their dismissal is not procedurally and substantively fair, there could be a chance that they could be reinstated or awarded compensation of up to 12 months.
So how important a precedent is this for other employers with undocumented staff?
This sets a very important precedent. All employers must take the necessary steps to ensure that they legally employ foreign nationals, and if they are not to simply dismiss them without following the proper procedure and without giving the employee proper notice. So if an employee is legally incapacitated from working in South Africa, they must still ensure that they follow a proper procedure in terminating the employee's employment and give them the necessary notice in terms of the basic conditions of employment or as per their contract of employment, whichever is more favorable.
And Navani, I suppose it also raises the question about whether human resource managers need to be offering assistance with visa renewal. Would that be part of their scope, their remit, their job?
Yes, this is definitely advisable. And to actually have your administration well in order so that HR would know when an employee's visa is coming up for renewal and to deal with that way in advance, because as you might know, there are certain backlogs experienced and delays, and you wouldn't want to then apply for the visa too late.
Just a final one. As a result of this ruling, is it fair to interpret it as potentially punishing employers for simply trying to comply with the law, or is it a little more nuanced than that?
No, it is a little bit more nuanced. I don't think it is a punishment. It is well established in our labor relations that all employees are entitled to fair labor practices. And it is the duty of the employer to ensure that they legally employ people and that they deal with them properly and ensure that any dismissal is procedurally and substantively fair.
Thank you very much indeed. That's Nivani Mudli, Associate Director at the law firm Weber Wenzel.
MoneyWeb at midday for all your up-to-date stories.
Now, a new study by the University of Pretoria paints a positive picture of South Africa's life insurance industry, with an overall customer satisfaction score of 74.1 out of 100. That's well ahead of global averages, and just a 6.6% of policyholders reporting issues. The sector, it seems to me, seems to be performing strongly. Quick claims handling, capable staff, strong digital tools all standing out. But beyond the numbers, how well does the industry truly serve its consumers when life throws up serious challenges? So let's take a closer look at this research and what it really tells us. Professor Andre Schroeder is with us, head of the industry chair in customer experience at the University of Pretoria. Prof, a very warm welcome. So let's start at a high level if we can. What do you think is behind the strong satisfaction scores in the index?
Well, the index is a new index that we're trying to actually understand the role of customer experience towards customer satisfaction. So the degree to which you, when you engage with your provider, when you call your life insurance company, when you claim, when you take out a policy, it's all those engagements in various forms through different channels has a certain experience. And as a result of that experience, there's a cognitive, let's call it, a result that would leave you satisfied or not satisfied. And that's pretty much what drives this. I think the nature of life insurance is, compared to, for instance, banking, you wouldn't necessarily engage with your life insurance company on a monthly basis, definitely not on a daily basis. And that in itself makes a little bit of a difference. So generally things are good, or you hope that it's good, for the day that you do need the benefit of why you've actually got the life insurance, is to look after your loved ones. And you're not going to get the benefit of that. So it's actually quite a selfish type product category, if you really think of it. Whereas when you buy food, you buy food for your own consumption. Mm. But you could also, in this case, you're buying food for someone else. And in a certain sense, and that in itself, I think, drives the higher level of the customer experience index.
Prof, I think the key word that you used in that answer was maybe the word hope. And I'm just wondering if a high score on paper is always a sign of real world success in this industry.
Yeah, very, very much so. If you look at the index, one of the things that we do highlight is the problems experienced is when things go wrong. And that's usually at a time when you don't really want things to go wrong. And that is, it could be in the process when you need to change a debit order, or you need to change address, or you need to change beneficiaries, you know, the normal things in terms of the upkeep and the maintenance of your policy. But when things go wrong at the claims stage, it's not you, it is someone else. And that in itself then lends, an added sort of complexity to this. For instance, we see 7% on average customers reporting problems experienced. Now, 7% doesn't sound much, but if you take 7% of all life policyholders in South Africa, it is a substantial amount of people that actually has a problem. And then add to that, and I say this inverted commas, 53% are completely resolved. Now, that is That is a good figure, and I think that drives the overall index to a higher level. But the inverse of that is 19% of that are completely unresolved. And that's, as they say, the devil lies in that detail.
So let's look at that 6.6 or 7% of people reporting issues. But that number, I think, could also maybe miss those who either disengaged, gave up, or maybe are just unaware of how to escalate a problem.
Yep, you're absolutely right. In the index, we've added, there's quite a controversy currently in the measurement of customer satisfaction and customer experiences. A lot of people are supporters of the so-called Net Promoter Score that measures the likelihood to recommend. And in terms of engagement, that still is always an intention, which we just said that keyword is hope. Mm. So it's almost like a promise. You hope, and therefore you will or you will not. But then we also looked at the actual behavior. So did you recommend? Did you change your policy? Did you close? Did you lapse the policy? And those are the actual behaviors. You know, the loyalty is only as good as the behavior that follows that. And that is where we see the lack of engagement is because they are disengaged and they don't actually respond to that. We actually get people that says upwards of 30%, 40% in some cases, have either a query or a worry or an uncertainty, but yet they don't escalate that to an actual query or an inquiry. That is what you just referred to as that lack of engagement. It's either because you will only complain when you think that there's high probability that something will be done about it.
It's interesting that the customers praise service delivery, and I think we've both referenced digital tools, but it's, I think, fair to say that there is still a degree of hesitation or even confusion around life insurance products in South Africa and sometimes the complexity.
Yes, absolutely so. The fact that we measure this particular industry, we looked at the traditional life insurance companies and the accompanying investment part of that. You know, when you talk life insurance, there's usually also a sort of a investment, let's call it retirement planning, added to that. And that in itself, reality plays a role. Now, yes, there's online tools, but how much of this complex product is still sold through a broker or a wealth advisor or, you know, someone that needs to advise you, because the complexity is just so, so difficult for the normal man on the street and woman on the street to understand.
So have you discerned anything then about how consumers feel about actual or real value that they're getting? And I'm thinking of maybe fair premiums or meaningful benefits.
Yep.
Or in many cases, maybe you just settle for what is available.
Yeah. It is interesting that although the index came out at 74.1 for the industry as a whole, the numbers differ between the different providers that we measured. We had the five major brands measured in here. But it starts off with a component we call quality of experience. That is on a level of 80. Now, that is even higher than the 74. But in between that lies what we call value of the experience. So the degree to which you value your engagement. And that falls from 80 to 73. That is 7 index points lower. That tells us that, yes, it might be a good service, but is it valued? You know, I have to call again. I'll have to tell my whole story again to another person. I can't talk to the same agent again. You know, that's the type of things that we talk about, value. The social value, you read social media postings and people say this is the worst life insurance by far because they had a negative experience. Mm. And then you ask yourself, am I at the right policy, right brand? That's what we refer to.
Just a quick one in conclusion, again, back to the study itself. I think I heard you say you focus on the 5 biggest insurers. Is that really a complete view, or do you think that smaller or maybe even emerging providers would paint a very different picture about the industry?
You're absolutely right. This is at the very beginning. Our index only saw its first sort of measurement in the banking industry in 2024. And then life insurance was soon after that. It's the second industry that we do. And based on previous experience in doing a similar benchmark, it takes time until we actually got enough subscribers to add that. For instance, in banking, we initially had the five major banks. Now it's expanded to nine banks. It includes the likes of Time Bank and Investec and RMB Private and so on. Mm. So I think what will follow after this round of our index is that we will add the sort of digital life insurance providers, the newer kids on the block. And that will provide another angle that we currently don't have with just the traditional five big brands.
And it'll be interesting to see what score emerges from that. I am going to leave it to Professor Adri Schroeder. Thank you very much indeed, Head of the Industry Chair of Customer Experience at the University of Pretoria.
You're listening to MoneyWeb at Midday.
Tourism and the economy now, and a new Northwest University study finds that hunting tourism is contributing a staggering 44 billion rand to South Africa's economy, and most of it, says the study, flows into rural areas. But the question is, can this often controversial industry keep growing? I'm in conversation now with one of the authors of the report, Professor Piet van der Merwe from the institution. So, Professor, first up, can you explain to me how you got to that figure and perhaps who benefits most?
Okay, Jeremy, thank you for the opportunity. We did some research since 2005 on the economics of hunting. But this time around, we look at both international and local hunters. So we did the same survey at the same time. And then we used the SAM, a social accounting matrix, to determine the spending of hunters. And what this does is that you look at direct, indirect, and induced spending. And that's when we came up with this number that is 44 billion rand, which was contributed to the hunting industry.
And which specific areas in South Africa benefit the most?
The areas that benefit the most is rural areas, and the sectors that benefit the most, because we also, when you do a social accounting matrix, you look at different sectors like your mining, agriculture, and there's about eight of nine that you run it through. So the rural areas benefit the most due to the fact that agriculture benefit the most. And we know all the hunting farms in these places are rural areas. Limpopo, Free State Province, North West, Northern Cape provinces are all provinces that is high in hunting and lots of hunting farms. So the rural areas do benefit a lot from hunting industry.
There's no doubt that it is a major contributor to the economy, but the optics suggest that it's simply rich tourists shooting animals and that it's not ethical and that it's not sustainable. And it's difficult to overcome that perceptual argument.
Yeah, I mean, if one look at ethical, what is ethical for me might not be ethical for you, and what's moral for me might not be moral for you. I mean, if one look at what's your religion, where you grew up, your culture, your social status, all those things play an ethical role. But looking at saying that refer to rich tourists that come and hunt, that is not true. I mean, for some people, it's a lifetime saving that they come to hunt some of the African species. This is for our international market. But if we look at our local market, which is the biggest market of a hunting market, they hunt for meat. These people hunt for meat. It's a green type of meat. There's no antibiotics, no grow-off mines and these type of things. So 99% of South Africans that hunt. And again, as I said, this is our biggest hunting market. They hunt to eat meat. That's a very good protein for them in their houses.
Difficult, of course, to distinguish between legal hunting, as you're outlining it, and poaching. Again, there's a lot of blur in that argument, isn't there, Professor?
Yeah, I mean, poaching is when people go and hunt illegal. I mean, for example, you put a snare somewhere or you drive on a road and you take your rifle and you hunt from a road. That's illegal hunting. But our hunting, all of them take place in a legal sense. If you look at your South African hunters, you need a permit to go and hunt. If it's an exempted game farm, the game farm owner can give the hunter a permit. Your international hunters can't hunt here without any permits. It's impossible for them to come and hunt without permits and to be legal. So the hunting industry is regulated by the hunters' organizations. These guys do hunt legal. But we also have poaching problems. But that's not your normal hunters.
You talk about rural communities benefiting. I'm just wondering whether it's real, sustainable, long-term value economically or just something which is seasonal.
No, I think it's quite long-term. If you look when hunting really started to evolve or develop, it was around about the 1980s when we realized that there's a value to wildlife. And that created that farmers turned the normal cattle farms to game farms. And I mean, since then, we still have hunting going on, and it's sustainable because we see a growth in hunting industry. We see a growth in game farms. We see a growth in our number of wildlife we are due to hunting and due to the fact that hunting has an economic value, or game has economic value. If we're going to take away the economic value of game, we will definitely see a decrease in hunting. And the economic value of game was created due to the fact that we have ownership of wildlife. Mm. So if you have the right fences, you can own wildlife. You can own an elephant, you can own a lion. And that gave it economic value. And some areas in our communities or rural areas, cattle farming and crop farming is not suitable. But wildlife, which is adapted to African conditions, are more suitable, and you can use it as economic driver in those areas.
Do you think enough is being done by tourism bodies, both provincially and nationally, to promote sustainable and ethical hunting as a viable option for visitors?
No. But our government, even if you go to trade shows, you never see them marketing hunting in South Africa. They're afraid that if they go and market hunting, that they will impact negatively on our ecotourism and normal tourism market. So we never see them market hunting. And as I indicate, hunting is quite a huge industry. And I would love them to more support hunting, especially in provinces and areas where not normal tourism is that suitable. I mean, we can have ecotourism in quite a variety of places, but some areas is not really suitable for your normal photographic safaris and ecotourism. And this is where hunting comes in so good that we can use it there. And I would love to see our government and local provincial government. There are some of the provinces that realize the importance of hunting, like I've been dealing with guys in Limpopo and the Northern Cape and so. But in general, they really don't market us as a hunting destination.
So what do you think the hunting lobby or the hunting community does to promote itself better, but also overcome some of the concerns that you have outlined to me?
I mean, if you look at the international market, these guys normally attend some of the trade shows in America, USA. There's a number of Safari Club International. There's quite a number of them that they do attend, where they market South Africa. And I mean, if you look at this, most of the international hunters that come to South Africa do a pre and post tour. So they hunt for 10 or what days, and then they go to Kruger or maybe some Cape Town or these places. The research showed that they at least do 2 or 3 days hunting trip. So they market themselves. The South African guys, they normally use platforms like social media to market them, or also using some of the hunting magazines that they market them. And also, this is a very big word of mouth thing. If you enjoy hunting at a certain farm, you will tell your friends, and obviously they will also attend or go to this place. So this is how they normally market their own products.
Professor Piet van der Merwe from Northwest University, thank you very much indeed. And that's where we're going to leave it. You've been listening to MoneyWeb at Midday. We're here every weekday at noon with the latest in current affairs, the economy and policy. You can always catch the podcast version a little later. Thank you for making us part of your day. Until next time, goodbye.
Listen to the daily live stream of MoneyWeb at Midday, or download episodes on moneyweb.co.za, the MoneyWeb app, Apple Podcasts and Spotify. Or follow MoneyWeb News on social media for more updates. MoneyWeb, your trusted source for business and investment insights.